This is Wealth Wake Up on KGMI with Dick Donahue.
The opinions voiced in Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, financial, or tax advisor prior to investing. Securities offered through Cetera Advisor Networks, member FINRA, SIPC. Investment advice offered through CWM, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Cetera Advisor Networks is under separate ownership from any other named entity. Guests of Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue are not affiliated with Cetera Advisor Networks, CWM, LLC, or Asset Advisors, LLC.
Welcome to Wealth Wake Up. This is Dick Donahue with you this Saturday morning here on KGMI. And we are pre-recording today's show as both Camille and I had other commitments we needed to keep for today. Anyway, I'm going to start out talking about the trade war and the fact that it could harm Americans' retirement savings. There are increasing concerns of tariffs disrupting overseas earnings, and it continues to brew. So Donald Trump's brewing trade war could have another collateral victim, Americans' retirement savings. The second quarter officially ended on July 29th, and by next week, large U.S. companies will start reporting how they did during the period. Most analysts think that those reports will be rosy. Overall, earnings for companies in the S&P 500 index are expected to rise slightly more than 20% from a year ago, which is the second fastest quarterly pace since 2010, according to FactSet. Sales are expected to be up on an average of nearly 9%. And normally that would be unqualified good news for Americans' retirement accounts. S&P 500 index funds make up three of the top 10 largest holdings in America's 401k accounts. If you split the companies in the S&P 500 into two groups, those generate 50% or more of their sales outside the U.S., and those that don't, well, the bottom lines of the companies in the first group are expected to grow by nearly 24% in the second quarter, compared with 17% for companies in the second group. Again, the first group, those that generate 50% or more of their sales from outside the U.S., again, expected to grow 24% versus 17% on those companies that generate most of their earnings in the U.S. The same trend held for sales, up nearly 13% for the first group compared to 7% for the second. This is where tariffs come in. The second quarter will give the first look at whether fears of a trade war have disrupted those overseas earnings. Probably not yet, at least according to analysts. That's why they are predicting stronger earnings, though those high expectations do present the possibility that they could fall short of forecasts. And the real question is what effect Trump's escalating trade war will have on profits for the rest of the year. And it's not just tariffs that threaten to choke off the foreign sales of U.S. companies. Outside the U.S., global economic growth, which seemed certain a year ago, appears to be fading. On top of that, the dollar is up about 5% for the past 3 months compared with other global currencies, and that's more bad news for U.S. exporters, making their goods more expensive overseas. Indeed, strategists noted recently that the projections for the S&P 500 companies with a high percentage of international sales have started to fall. Companies with more domestic exposure have not experienced the same downward sales revisions from analysts. And that's why tariffs matter so much. The S&P 500 has a price-to-earnings ratio of 16.9 based on next year's earnings. That market valuation is based on a steady sales growth rate of at least in a high single digits, if not higher. About 40% of the sales of the companies in the S&P 500 come from overseas, and an estimated 60% of the sales growth. If a trade war chokes that off, it's hard to see how stocks stay at current heights. And now we're talking about a blow to 401ks. the news last week that Harley Davidson was moving some jobs overseas or received for some condemnation, but not a huge backlash. A few jobs is a price, it appears, Trump and his supporters are willing to pay. A sustained drop in the investment that makes up core of most Americans in retirement savings might be another story. Going to have to be one that we're going to have to continue to watch. It may have impacts. We need to be aware of them. Got another question here that we've been looking at some things, and it says, when you die, who gets the airline miles? Well, you know, there's a new law that provides executors with access to digital assets estate planning needs to include such assets. When you die, who owns the pictures on that Facebook page? Who has control of their electronic bill payment sites or Bitcoin account? Who is responsible for shutting down or memorializing social media sites? Digital rights ownership is an increasing complex issue as our online lives continue to expand. Are you prepared to safeguard these assets after death? If you do nothing in advance, disposition of digital assets goes according to the terms of service for each individual site, which varies widely. In fact, many survivors have been shocked by sites that do not allow transfer of ownership or access upon death, or that complicate the settlement of the estate. Rules have been more flexible for minors in states that allow parents or guardians to manage their deceased children's account, yet some families have had to get court orders to obtain rights to their loved ones' digital accounts, a process that can take months or years. Several states began to take action by passing what we call the Fiduciary Access to Digital Access Act, and the legislation gives the executor access to all digital accounts and allowed digital assets to pass according to the decedent's will. However, it ran into legal difficulties based on privacy. Some people, for instance, did not want their executor to see highly personal information, such as their emails and texts, and lawsuits ensued. The acts were gradually amended to resolve these issues until finally in 2017, states began passing the revised Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act, or RUFADAA. 40 states have now made it law, and it's pending in 5 more, as well as the District of Columbia, and it should soon be nationwide. So what does this mean? Well, digital property now needs to be part of the estate planning process, and you need to prepare now for your digital afterlife. So RUFADAA allows the executor or another fiduciary appointed in the will to have access to any electronic or digital sites necessary to settle the estate. The necessary sites are largely those involving finances or financial assets, including shopping accounts, automatic bill paying, and online banking. That very narrow provision protects your privacy, as it does not allow the executor to access texts, emails, and more private information. Yet, RUFADAA allows for further permission if the decedent clearly states it in the will. This permission can cover points such as whether a Facebook page is closed or maintained as a memorial page, whether a blog is deleted or archived and kept, and all of your other data for other digital sites. Sites that fall under the RUFADAA are required to give access to the named beneficiary or executor, but that process can take time, involves proving that the site that you died, if usernames and passwords are accessible immediately, airline miles can be transferred, sites can be closed, and other desired actions can happen with less complication. It is important to note, though, that you should never include usernames and passwords in the will, as it becomes part of a public document upon death. So this is something for you to talk to your estate planning, your attorneys when you're doing it. Just a little word for the wise. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up here on KGMI, and we'll be back shortly.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again, just my children and my wife.
Welcome to Wolf Wake Up Live. This is Dick Donahue with you this Saturday morning. And actually, this session is pre-recorded, so we are not live today. But normally we are Saturdays at 11. And of course, we always also have our program on Sunday mornings at 9. So I invite you to join us. Anyway, we're Asset Advisors. We're located out on the Pacific Highway. That's out in Ferndale. Actually, out on the Pacific Highway, out next to Wilson's Furniture in the Pacific Commerce Center. Our address is 5060 Pacific Highway, Suite 101. That's Ferndale 98248. Our phone number 360-733-1200. We invite you to give us a call and also check out our website at assetadvisorsllc.net or wealthwakeup.com. Okay. Well, you know, this little thing, a report came out this week talking about the Trump White House, the smaller staff. It spends less on salaries than on the Obama White House did. So, and they're looking at over $20 million in taxpayer funds that could be saved at the end of President Donald Trump's first term in office due to a leaner White House operation. The new report on the White House office personnel revealed that Trump has a significantly smaller staff than his predecessor did at this time, according to an analysis by Open the Books, a government watchdog organization that focuses on spending. And although the White House personal budget is an infinitesimal part of the $3.9 trillion federal budget, it is an important forecasting indicator showing Trump's deep commitment to cut the size, scope, and power of the federal government and to rein in waste. As of June 30th, the White House currently employs 374 people. That's actually three fewer than were employed at this time a year ago in 2017. That's also significantly lower than the 469 that were employed in 2010, which would have been in the second year of then-President Barack Obama's term. So that's looking at like 25% fewer employees at this point in time. In addition to maintaining a smaller staff size, Trump's White House has also cut payroll by over 5 million when compared to Obama's 2015 staff. The 2018 payroll currently sits at 36.2 million. In contrast to the 2015 payroll, which Open the Books reported exceeded more than 40.9 million. Open the Books also noted that by maintaining a smaller staff and by refusing to take a salary, that Trump has already saved about $11 million in taxpayer dollars, and that the four-year savings could easily top $22 million. Each quarter, Trump has actually donated his salary to the Department of Education, the Department of Veterans Affairs, and the Department of Health and Human Services. And among the various areas in the West Wing with reduced staff, the office of the First Lady, Melania Trump, is notable. Trump has a staff under her that's half the size of then-First Lady Michelle Obama's in 2009. Trump currently has 10 staffers, while Obama had 24. That's like 40% of the staff that Michelle Obama had. I guess it just kind of shows how it is when you're spending other people's money, my money, your money, how much sometimes, you know, some people pay attention to it and others don't. But I kind of like that fact that they can get the job done a lot fewer people. So we're continuing to talk about Washington spending, and you know, it's really the key to what happens with the tax reform and the success of tax reform, because more than $21 trillion in debt, it looks like Washington has forgotten some basic economics. Peacetime and a strong economy are universally agreed upon criteria for when government should start to reduce spending and pay down the debt, and we're not doing it. Instead, Washington's in the process of passing appropriations that are a dramatic departure from anything resembling fiscal or economic sanity. The now certain return of trillion-dollar deficits threatens to undermine the Republicans' most significant legislation and economic accomplishment, tax reform. In stark contrast to government spending, properly designated tax cuts let people keep more of their own money and expand the economic opportunity. Tax reform's promise was simple. American families will spend about $2,000, send about $2,000 less to Washington each year. But that won't last if we continue to have deficits of $5,600 per family per year as we did in fiscal year 2017. The U.S. agencies such as the Congressional Budget Office and international bureaucracies such as the International Monetary Fund all seem to agree that tax reform will boost the U.S. economy, but unprecedented levels of debt and large deficits threaten to drag economic growth back down in the following years. Tax reform already has created opportunity for businesses and workers. More than 800 businesses have said that they have offered new and improved benefits to their workers because of tax reform, higher wages, bigger bonuses, and better retirement plans. Layoffs are rare and employers are hiring. Unemployment is close to historic lows at about 4%, which is the lowest rate since 2000. Small businesses are more optimistic than ever. As measured by the National Federation of Independent Businesses Small Business Optimism Index, and businesses are again increasing investment in America. New business investments in real estate, equipment, factories have jumped more than 21% compared to the first quarter of last year. Yet, the growth from tax reform could be more than 50% larger over the long run if American workers and investors were certain that their new lower taxes would continue. The 2017 tax cuts are largely temporary, and a sustainable budget is a necessary precursor to permanently cutting America's taxes. So get your act together, Congress, will you? And we see a little headline here about GM and their finance charade, and maybe we've seen this before. They have a plan, GM does, but it doesn't involve electric vehicles. Sure, the green mobiles get all the headlines, but they don't produce a lot of dough. For that, you need to sell a bunch of cars, and that you need clients that can get financing. So enter the new GM credit unit. In 2010, GM spent $3.5 billion to purchase AmeriCredit, a subprime lending specialist. The unit is now called GM Financial. But this wasn't the car company's first go-around with financing. For those of us with a memory that can reach back before the financial crisis, we remember the monster that ate the company, General Motors Acceptance Corporation, or GMAC. To sell more cars in the 2000s, GMAC consistently reached further down the credit well, financing clients with spottier credit records. The company moved units, but the loans didn't stick when the economy rolled over. And by that time, GMAC had ventured into other areas like financing subprime mortgages, which also went south. So during the bankruptcy, but not a bankruptcy, when the unions got the assets and the bondholders, equity investors, and taxpayers got the shaft, General Motors had to punt GMAC. To qualify for a big, fat bailout, the financing entity had to become a bank. That's how Ally Bank started. I've almost found it ironic that a bank born out of such financial shenanigans and bad faith dealings would use advertising that emphasizes trust and doing the right thing. And what do I know? Back to GM Financial. Since acquiring AmeriCredit, GM has beefed up the financing arm. The efforts went into overdrive after 2016 when several subprime auto lenders hit the skids. Companies like Summit Financial, Springtree Lending, and Pelican Auto Financing were all specialized in lending to people with a credit score of 620 or less have gone out of business. This leaves the auto industry struggling to finance those marginal buyers so car makers can keep their units moving off their lots. The slowdown in subprime lending is part of the reason that auto sales slowed after 2016. But all that is history. GM is counting on GM Financial to bolster sales by offering more lending to poor credit borrowers. enabling them to drive the vehicle of their dreams off the lot, typically with a very high interest rate loan. The transaction leaves GM smiling from ear to ear as it makes money on the car and the loan. The best part of all, such lending is particularly helpful in a weak economy when traditional lenders tighten their lending standards to avoid losses. When the economy inevitably rolls over, GM will be the perfect position to keep those loans and cars rolling. Of course, that's the little issue of repayment. Today, with unemployment at 3.84%, the average hourly earnings is up 2.7% from last year. 5.8% of subprime loans are at least 60 days overdue. That's a higher rate than during the financial crisis, and when 60 days plus delinquencies reach 5.1%. Maybe there's a good reason why subprime auto lenders are shutting their doors, and perhaps regular banks are crazy when they tighten lending standards in weak economic times. But hey, that's not GM's problem. The car company has developed an excellent plan to keep things going. And if it needs to issue bonds backed up by the questionable car loans and then slice them up as derivatives to keep the money rolling in, that's the worst that could happen. GM might make cars worth considering again, but I'll keep my distance from its stock. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up Live here on KGMI this Saturday morning. Thank you for listening. We'll be back after news and sports. Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up Live this Saturday morning here on KGMI. As I noted earlier, we are pre-recording today's show as both Camille and I had other commitments that we needed to keep for today. So we'll be back live next Saturday, but today we are pre-recording. You know, there's a tax loophole from the 1960s that could let the wealthy tap a 21% corporate rate. And these are provisions that were related to investments held offshore, and it could save Americans millions of dollars in taxes. There's an obscure tax provision from the 1960s that was left untouched by the tax overhaul that could let individual investors seize for themselves the largest corporate tax cut in U.S. history. The measure, signed into law by President John F. Kennedy, was designed to prevent Americans from indefinitely shielding themselves from taxes by keeping investments offshore. It forced them to pay taxes annually on these investments, but gave them the option to have the income taxed at a corporate tax rate instead of an individual rate. Well, for the past few decades, investors had very little reason to pick the corporate rate since it was nearly the same as the top personal rate. But all that changed in December of 2017 when the tax law slashed the corporate rate to 21%, 16 percentage points lower than the top federal individual tax rate. And since the Trump law was signed, the tax legislation, accountants and attorneys in Internal Revenue Service have spent months attempting to discern the implications. One reason for the struggle is that rather than replace old tax laws with a new regime, Republicans grafted the new law onto decades of old regulations, leading to unintended consequences. Tax professionals say they think the offshore loophole could help wealthy Americans who have investments that yield interest, rent, or royalties defer millions of dollars in taxes. Here's how it works. An investor creates a company overseas, known as a controlled foreign corporation. Then he or she places bonds, rental properties, and other investments that generate passive income into the corporation and elects to pay the corporate rate every year instead of ordinary income tax rates. There's a catch, though. The taxpayer pays the corporate rate as long as the money is kept abroad. But if that income is distributed back to the taxpayer in the U.S., then it will be taxed again. That makes it ideal for investors who are looking to let their earnings grow for years offshore. So electing the corporate tax retreatment, though, could result in some taxpayers ultimately paying more in taxes given the double taxation if they plan on collecting it in the near term. Investors should weigh how many years they plan on letting the investment stay offshore and then calculate the benefit. The corporate loophole may ultimately be best suited for the wealthiest investors who don't actually need access to the money. You pay corporate taxes, but you can't get your money on hands on the money if you were to follow this type of activity. Something to be aware of, something to look for, something to look at. Doesn't apply to very many people, but it does apply to some. You know, we do a lot of insurance. We have life insurance. We always have. Back in the 60s when I first started in the business, I told people to buy term life insurance. I still believe that that's the right way to go. But there are 8 life insurance mistakes that we see that clients make. And it's crucial that they take the correct path to proper coverage. So between enduring the underwriting process, paying the premiums, and considering the prospect of one's untimely demise, it's a surprise that we aren't always enthusiastic about talking about life insurance. Here are some of the errors that we've seen that could be in some things that you need to avoid. One, we find out first mistake, of course, is they don't buy it. According to a recent survey conducted by the website Bisto, 70% of American adults don't have any life insurance. Even worse, the study says 75% of parents in the millennial generation don't have any coverage. And it's egregious that so many moms and dads are leaving their children vulnerable to their financial damage inflicted by the loss of a parent's income and support. But even these childless singles should consider purchasing a policy, as it will likely be more expensive the longer they wait. Or they don't buy enough. Several hundred thousand dollars can sound like a lot of money to those who don't have much. But we know that it takes a lot more to replace a lost parent and a parent's paycheck. As a rule of thumb, families should have enough life insurance to cover current living expenses for as long as the children will depend on the parents, plus any higher education expenses. And if a family spends, say, $4,000 a month until a baby turns 21, that's $1 million at that child's birth to adulthood, given, again, without including the cost of college. Or they have the wrong kind of life insurance, and this is the most common mistake that we see people make. The premium cost of, say, $1 million of cash value life insurance policy will cause most young adults to react with shock and dismay, and they can't be blamed for abandoning the process at that point. But you should consider more affordable term life insurance instead. Depending on the company, and those rates are about 1/10 of what it would cost to purchase cash value policies with the same death benefits, or they buy it in the wrong place. Often the only life insurance coverage that people have is either been given to them as part of their employment, or they purchased it at work via a group coverage. And although some life insurance is better than none at all, this method is fraught with potential problems. First, the amount awarded to them by their employer is usually only 1 or 2 times their salaries and not enough for true financial security. And second, group policies often require little or no health screening. That's good news for employees with adverse health histories or conditions, but that means healthier insured participants end up subsidizing those who would otherwise pay more if insurance were purchased on an individual basis. And finally, if you leave the current employer, the employer provided life insurance might not remain in place. Then you'll be forced to obtain coverage on your own, which may be more expensive, or if your health deteriorates, may not be available at any price. So, of course, the other mistake we make here, I should say, is that they only buy it on the breadwinner. It's understandable why you would be hesitant to purchase life insurance on a stay-at-home parent who doesn't have any earned income. But a parent who doesn't work outside of the house still has economic value. And that parent, if it dies, it will cost the surviving parent precious time, money, and energy to replace the duties that that parent provided. Better yet, suitable life insurance proceeds on the stay-at-home parent's life could give the working parent the option of quitting his job if he loses his spouse. This freedom will allow him or her to devote more time to caring for the children and when they need it most. Or they don't go long enough. That's also a big issue we see. So whether it's due to idealism or naivety, most younger parents assume that their children will be self-sufficient by the time the kids turn 22 and, in theory, graduate from college. Older parents know how unlikely that scenario is to occur. Therefore, any term insurance should be purchased so that it will still be in place until the youngest child reaches his mid-20s. And even then, if the family hasn't been able to accumulate enough wealth, the proceeds could still be necessary for supporting a surviving empty nester parent into retirement and beyond. Or another mistake that we see they make is they don't protect the policy proceeds. If younger adults are remiss in the amount of life insurance they have, they usually are more lacking in proper estate planning. If the parents die while the children are young, these kids may get the estate and life insurance proceeds at an age of adulthood, usually 18 to 21, depending on the state. That amount of money could be disastrous to a parentless young adult. Instead, of parents should have a trust established to oversee the estate and assets until the children are old enough to handle the money wisely. And then there's a problem of canceling the policy too soon. Whether the life insurance owned by older clients is term or cash value, often the kids are on their own and they are financially independent. There is a temptation to cancel the policy and stop paying premiums. But that could be a mistake, purely for financial reasons. A rule of thumb to decide if you should keep a policy is to divide the death benefit by the remaining life expectancy in years of the insured. If that amount is greater than the annual cost of the premiums needed to maintain the coverage, it's probably a good idea to keep paying the premiums. In fact, when children who are the beneficiaries of the policy may even be motivated to pay the premiums themselves. So these are some things to think about. We're talking about life insurance. A lot of people don't want to, but we do a lot of term insurance, as I indicated. If you want to talk about it, give us a call, 733-1200. That's 360-733-1200, and we'll be back shortly.
'Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up Live. Dick Donahue with you this Saturday morning. As I noted before, we are pre-recorded today, so we are not taking calls. However, we will have our 9 o'clock show tomorrow morning, so next Saturday we'll be back live at 11 o'clock. So feel free to give us a call in the meantime if you got questions about show 733-1200. And I'm going to spend a little time here in this last section talking about how well do you know your United States geography and demographics. So if you're more than half right, count yourself a statesman or a stateswoman of the first order. You know, you've probably visited many U.S. states, maybe even all 50 of them. So you think you know the lay of the land? But every state conceals mysteries. Here are 15 brain teasers to test your knowledge on state geography and demographics. Good luck. So here's the first question. What is the southernmost state in the United States? California, Hawaii, Texas, or Florida? Well, the answer there is in Hawaii. Hilo, Hawaii is the southernmost place in the 50 states with a population of over 25,000. And then which state has the capital city with the most residents? Massachusetts, Florida, New York, or Arizona? Little surprise here, too. Arizona. Most state capitals tend to be separate their political centers from their larger economic centers. With a population of 4.418 million, Phoenix, Arizona is an exception. And which state has the capital city with the fewest inhabitants? Vermont, Nevada, South Dakota, or Missouri? Well, Vermont. with a population of just under 8,000. Montpellier is the capital city with the fewest people. And which pair of American cities represent the greatest distance between two mainland points in the contiguous 48 states? Seattle and Key West, Florida. San Diego to Camden, Maine. Point Arena, California to West Quoddy Head, Maine. Or Astoria, Oregon to Riviera Beach, Florida. Well, your answer there is Point Arena, California to West Quoddy Head, Maine. Its distance is 2,892 miles. Next, which state has the largest number of lakes completely within its state boundaries? Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Florida, or Minnesota? The answer there is Minnesota, which has 11,842 lakes of 10 acres or more. Alaska sometimes claims a larger number, but there's no definitive list as there is in Minnesota. Okay, which state has the largest lake entirely within its own boundaries? Minnesota, Utah, Alaska, or Florida? Well, that one, Great Salt Lake in Utah. 1,088,000 acres. It's the largest lake entirely within one state's borders. And what state has the longest ocean coastline? Alaska, California, Florida, or Hawaii? The answer there, 6,640 miles of ocean coastline, ranked first is Alaska. Florida, California, and Hawaii are runners-up. And what's the only letter in the alphabet that is not contained in any of the names of 50 U.S. states? B, as in boy, Q, Z, or U? Well, the answer there is the only letter not in any of the names of the 50 states. If you guess Z, think Arizona. How about the letter B? Well, don't forget about Alabama. So the only letter that's not contained in all the letters is Q. And then which state is home to the most millionaire households per capita? The ratio of millionaire households to total population? Maryland, California, New Jersey, or Connecticut? Well, the answer there is Maryland, with 170,140 of the state's 2.25 million households are millionaires, according to the rankings that recently were published. And with a GDP of 2.499 trillion, almost 2.5 trillion, that's gross domestic product, California's economy ranks among the 10 largest national economies in the world. Between which two countries does California's economy rank? Well, Germany and the United Kingdom, the United Kingdom and France, India and Italy, or Brazil and Canada? And the answer there is they rank between the United Kingdom and France. They actually rank number 6. And what is the difference between the median household income of Maryland, the wealthiest state, and that of Mississippi, which is the poorest state? Is it $6,800, $2,700 difference, $34,291 difference, or $49,000 difference? And the answer there is $34,291. That's the difference between the number one ranked Maryland median household income of almost $74,000 and the number 50 ranked Mississippi at a little over $39,600. And then what state touches borders with the most neighboring states? Is it Missouri, Ohio, Kentucky, or Colorado, or Tennessee? I'm going to throw that fifth one in there because Missouri and or Tennessee are actually tied, which each of them border in 8 neighboring states. And at 608 miles, California and Nevada share the second longest border between neighboring states. Which two states share an even longer border? North Dakota and South Dakota, Oklahoma and Texas, Colorado and Utah, Arizona and New Mexico. Well, at 608 miles, California and Nevada share the second longest border between neighboring states. Which two states share the even longer border? Oklahoma and Texas share a border that is 715 miles long. And then what pair of states have the lowest and highest property tax loads, respectively, Hawaii and New Jersey, Alabama and Illinois, Louisiana and Connecticut, or South Carolina and New Hampshire? And the answer is Hawaii and New Jersey. The annual taxes for a home valued at $185,000 in Hawaii are just $501. In New Jersey, it's $4,437. And what is the state with the highest credit card debt? California, Connecticut, Maryland, or Alaska? Well, Alaska residents carry an average credit card debt load of $7,552. Other states are close followers. Iowa, with an average debt of $4,410, is the lowest. So, little geography, little economic questions there. Glad to share them with you. Got questions, want to give us a call and check on any of those with us, give us a call, 360-733-1200. Thank you for listening. Have a good day. We'll be back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock or 9 o'clock in the morning. Dick Donahue with you. Thanks for being with us.